from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The black population dwindled in most Bay Area communities over the past 10 years. According to census figures, in Oakland and Richmond, that decline was 23%. In San Francisco, 19%. And East Palo Alto, the drop was 31%. Concern about those numbers and what can be done to spur economic development and entrepreneurship is what's behind next week's State of the Race conference, sponsored by Bay Area Blacks in Philanthropy. In the hour ahead, we'll talk with conference organizers and presenters about their ideas for overcoming economic obstacles. And we'll hear about some new models for black entrepreneurship in the Bay Area. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome to Forum. Yesterday, President Obama made his case once again for a jobs bill, calling the current economic situation an emergency. For many Bay Area residents, that pronouncement won't come as news, especially for blacks living in the Bay Area. According to the latest census figure, more than a quarter of all black families in California now live below the poverty line, and the median black family income stands at $32,000 a year, one half the median income for Asian Americans. Concern about economic opportunity for African Americans is also the driving force behind a conference organized by a group called Bay Area Blacks in Philanthropy that will take place next week. The conference is called The State of the Race: African Americans Competing in the Regional Economy. Joining us now to talk about the conference and also the challenge of creating economic opportunity and entrepreneurship for blacks in the Bay Area are Jason Trimue. He is the Director of Business Development for the Roberts Enterprise Development Fund, and he's also on the board of Bay Area Blacks in Philanthropy. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us, Sean Ginwright. He's Associate Professor of Education in the Africana Studies Department and Senior Research Associate for the Cesar Chavez Institute for Public Policy at San Francisco State University. Sean Ginwright, good morning as well.
Good morning.
Joining us by phone this morning, Lena Miller. She's founder and co-executive director of Hunters Point Family, which is a community-based youth development organization for at-risk Bayview Hunters Point families and runs businesses that hire Hunters Point residents. Lena Miller, good morning as well.
Good morning.
And Jennifer B. Lyle joins us also. She is chief of operations for Building Blocks for Kids Collaborative, which focuses on how to build success for young people and their families in Richmond's Iron Triangle neighborhood. Jennifer Lyle, good morning as well.
Good morning.
Thanks all very much for being here this morning. I want to start with a couple of numbers that have gotten some attention in the press in recent months about the changes in the Bay Area population, black population in the Bay Area. Just let me read off a couple of these. In Oakland, the black population has declined over the last 10 years by 23%. Same number in Richmond, 23% decline. San Francisco, 19%. Berkeley, 20%. In East Palo Alto, the decline in the black population over the last 10 years, 31%. Dramatic changes, Sean Ginwright, in the look and face of the Bay Area. What does that tell you when you hear those numbers?
Well, you know, we actually did a study about the decline in African-American populations in San Francisco, and we had assumed that that decline was a result of folks wanting to sort of sell their homes and move back to Texas and buy, you know, larger homes. But we found that actually wasn't the case, right, that many black families were moving, were driven by quality of life indicators, right? Folks wanted safe neighborhoods. Folks wanted to be able to sleep well at night. Folks didn't want to hear gunshots. As I drove in this morning, the security brother, as I was driving into the garage, stopped me and said, "I moved too." Hmm. When I talked to him, he said, "You know, when I live in Vallejo, but I drive an hour and a half to work, but I don't hear gunshots, and I sleep, I sleep well at night, knowing my kids are relatively safe." And we heard this over and over and over again with a lot of the black families we interviewed.
And in fact, the one part of the Bay Area where the black population is growing are in places like Brentwood and mm-hmm. Tracy and Antioch in the burbs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the vanilla suburbs are now not as vanilla as they were. There's a large significant number of African American families that are leaving these urban cores to have a better quality of life, right?
Lena Miller, what are you seeing in Hunters Point Bayview in terms of people leaving? And then, of course, we'll get to what people, all of you, are involved in terms of getting people to stay. But I'm just curious about your sort of sense of what Sean Ginwright was just describing.
Well, you know, actually, we're seeing the same thing. When you talk about safety in the reality every day of losing your children, and you know so many people. I mean, there's like no degrees of separation, and it's multiple times of people losing their children, their loved ones. The things that black boys have to deal with living in San Francisco is really horrible. I mean, it's like a nightmare that most people don't even realize is going on in San Francisco. It's very, very dangerous. They can be robbed, they're, you know, victimized, and that's just kind of on the streets. There's a whole nother level of things that happens in the school just with, you know, racism that a lot of people aren't even aware of. A lot of times it's, you know, very subtle. So I think it's just like Dr. Ginwright said, you know, a lot of times what families are looking at is that they don't want to leave their neighborhood where they've grown up. On the other hand, they don't want to lose their children to homicide. And for so many of us, that is very, very real. No matter how you raise your children, no matter, you know, it just getting on the bus, there's a likelihood that something could happen to them where they'll lose their life.
Lena Miller, founder and co-executive director of Hunters Point Family. Jennifer Belisle, and in your organization, Building Blocks for Kids Collaborative in Richmond's Iron Triangle, does that mean then, when we think about economic development, I have to say the first thing I wouldn't have necessarily thought of was neighborhood safety. But is that where it has to start?
Yes. People have to feel safe to be in their communities, to stay in the communities. One thing that we see here is that there is very little just public traffic on the streets. So people don't even – they'll go outside, but for very little. And if they're even actually going to go to a store, they'll leave Richmond.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's been a real challenge here.
So, Jason Trimu, how does that begin – the task or the challenge then to overcome that in terms of business development? If people don't feel safe walking down the street, they're not going to frequent storefront businesses, as Jennifer Lyle was just describing. So what's the starting point then to begin to overcome that so that businesses can thrive?
Well, I agree with what was said previously, and I think when we look at the flight of African Americans from Bay Area communities, we also see a huge and rising income inequality. And so in these communities, for people to be able to stay in their communities, to start businesses in their communities, they have to have a base of patrons that will support them. And I think in communities that I've been involved with, in Bayview Hunters Point in particular, business attraction and small business development are vital to beginning to change the conversation in these communities, where residents of these communities can feel free to shop in their neighborhoods, have the amenities that all other neighborhoods have. And at the same time, obviously, to the extent that these businesses can be community owned and operated, that they can employ local residents, I think we can really begin to see people coming into these communities, moving back to these communities, and certainly the prosperity of these communities for the people that are already there.
What do we know about what works? Can you point me to models where that has begun to change, what a neighborhood looks, feels like?
Well, I think for one of the things that works has been around social enterprise. And Red F, the organization that I work for, has for the last 15 years been involved in helping nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, start and scale businesses, true businesses that compete in the marketplace and at the same time employ people who otherwise might face barriers to work, many of the individuals that are represented in the organizations on this call. And I think that by helping these nonprofits who are mission-motivated to serve their communities, to work in their communities, they know their communities, for them to be able to operate with support, with financial and technical assistance, real businesses, they're both serving a community benefit. They're providing something of value to the community that people are buying, as well as creating opportunities for people who otherwise would face 3 to 5 times the unemployment rates of most communities. chances for those individuals to get work experience and be able to be then launched into kind of the work world. So I think that we're starting to see more blurring of the lines between how social impact happens. And I think there is an acknowledgement that the marketplace has to play a role.
Jason Tremieux again. He's Director of Business Development for Red F, which stands for the Roberts Enterprise Development Fund, also on the board of Bay Area Blacks and Philanthropy, which is sponsoring next week's conference. Shanjin Roy, again, on in terms of what works, what do we know about how to begin to change that pattern of flight that we began the program describing?
Well, you know, there's two institutions that have always been a hallmark in black communities, and that's the black church and the black community-based organizations. And these institutions have always had rooted deep connections with black communities. But what we've seen over the past 20 years, really, is that black churches, for the most part, haven't been able to confront and address in a really powerful way the kind of crisis that we see in these communities. And so the role of the church in many ways has been sort of hasn't been able to address these. But then we have community-based organizations, and community-based organizations working with children, working with young people, have had the kind of relationships with parents and schools and so forth. And we see now that even community-based organizations are fragile and thin and unable to kind of confront these kinds of issues.
I want to drill down on what the community-based organizations, because both Elena Miller and Jennifer Lyle can speak to things that they are doing in their neighborhoods. But I'm interested to also, before we get to that, in what you were saying about black churches. Are you suggesting also then that there has been a decline in the influence of black churches within those communities and that that has an economic impact?
Absolutely. I think that black churches have always played a major role. But this particular issue, what I'm talking about is post-crack black America, yeah. That the black church hasn't been able to really have a major impact in these issues. And as a result of the one institution that has always had a major impact on the kind of conditions in our – when that institution has not been able to do that, then we begin to see a whittling away of the ties that hold black communities together.
It's interesting because there's been a lot of talk in really the last two presidential administrations about involving the faith community and trying to solve community problems. It sounds like in some ways you're suggesting it needs to go the other way around, that there needs to be some help in helping the faith communities reaffirm their strength.
Absolutely. I think everybody is sort of wrenching their hands, right? I don't think black churches and pastors are sort of say we don't want to deal with it. I think they're scratching their heads,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Pastor Michael McBride in Oakland has brought together a number of black pastors in Oakland to try to address these conditions, right? Where these churches are working together to really confront these issues with black youth, and so there are efforts to do this in the faith community, but I think that black churches are trying to figure these things out as well.
Shanjin Wright is Associate Professor of Education in the Africana Studies Department and Senior Research Associate at the Cesar Chavez Institute at San Francisco State University. Lena Miller at Hunters Point Family, pick up on that, if you would, on the role of black churches within your community, but also then examples of how you are trying to spur business development and the kind of successes that you're having with that in Bayview Hunters Point.
Well, the thing people always say about Bayview Hunters Point is that we have a liquor store on every corner and a church on every corner, too.
Right.
Like, you
right.
know, those are... We have such a dense population of churches in this community, but I think, you know, by and large, the youth really feel, you know, disconnected from the churches. And I think the thing is that a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of judgment in religion, and a lot of these youth, they've gotten to the state that they're in. I mean, they've had tremendous, tremendous trauma in their lives, starting from very young children. We're talking about neglect. We're talking about abuse. You know, that's why a lot of these young people are out there. That's why they're kind of living the lives that they've lived. And so when people kind of come to them and say, oh, it's a choice, or you should be doing this, without really addressing the pain that they've endured, you know, things that people really have no idea, and showing that kind of compassion, and then meeting them where they're at and try to work them back and bring them and say, you know, back into the light and say, listen, life is good. It can be good. You know, things can start to change. And as you become an adult, you have more control over your life and making your circumstance good. You know, it's really a different context, but you have to be there with them. And again, they have to be addressed with love and with compassion and not judgment. And that's one of the things I think the church hasn't really been able to wrap itself around or really to deal with the issues that they're dealing with. I think in terms of economic development, I mean, one of the problems is that the traditional model of the nonprofit has been, you know, help the kids out, after school program, if only you'd make the right choices, conflict resolution, don't get a gun. And really, the reality is people are out there trying to survive. These children are out there trying to survive. And if you don't show them how to survive, and it's not by going to get a job, an entry level job, you know, in retail or stocking, you know, business is an art, it's a science. And if we don't begin to really teach our children that, then they're not going to be successful. So the social entrepreneurial or the social enterprise model is a way, it's the replacement of a family business, which we don't have much left in the African-American community in San Francisco, I can say for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about that and what those skills are. If it's not going out and getting a job, you know, an entry-level retail job, Jason Trimu, what is it? What are the skills that have to be taught, along with the compassion that Lena Miller was describing, that allow people to sort of jump into the entrepreneurial position?
Well, I think if any of us think about our own work experience and our own first jobs, what we understand from that is that while, yes, we may have learned some skills on the job, what having a job teaches you goes far beyond the hard skills you learn. I mean, there's the soft skills. There's how to participate on a team, how to take instruction, how to take orders, how to take directives. There's the opportunity to, when you're in a job, a real job, earning money, how to manage your money, how to make smart decisions with your money. And I think that those are the kinds of skills that social enterprise and other types of supported employment opportunities provide that – when it's just a training program, and this is not to disparage training programs, but when you get at the end of a 10-week or 12-week program and you've got a certificate, but the labor market says, we don't have a job for you, you're really discouraged. And so social enterprise, the types of businesses that Lena and her organization run, are providing real on-the-job training, and they're doing so in a way that's really not only helping these individuals prepare for the workforce, but potentially also prepare to run their own businesses.
I want to come back to Lena's examples, but before I do, Jennifer B. Lyle, weigh in on this too in terms of what you think kids in Richmond's Iron Triangle neighborhood in particular, what the specific skills are they need to climb out of the situation they currently find themselves in.
So I want to – I hear your question, but I also want to kind of touch on something that Lena started to talk about.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that's this, you know, I think, and not saying that anyone has done this here on this call, but that there is a simplification of what are the things that we need to do to address the issues that we're seeing in these communities. And I think that there are some particular experiences that people have had that make getting jobs, entering the job market, and actually even being in the game, very difficult. And so when you ask, you know, what's successful and what are good models, a lot of good models are innovation. So, you know, some of the things that, you know, are happening with Baby Hunters Point Family are things that have inspired our work because we're taking a comprehensive approach. So we're understanding there's serious trauma that families have experienced. And so we're understanding that we need to address some of the mental health issues that young people and their parents are experiencing. We're understanding that there are people who are losing their homes every day, and their understanding about financial wellness and health and wellness is not current. And so there are examples like SparkPoint that have comprehensive services available to families, and so that they can think about how they, you know, save their lives, save their families, get a job, and get their credit score up. So I think that there are tremendous barriers that families in this community face to actually even thinking about getting to a job or even considering a job. And so that's a lot of where we focus our energy. How do we help people through their mental health barriers? How do we help people feel safe and secured to go to the center so that they can get some support? And then how do we help and sustain people? And I think Lena said something about, you know, love. And there's a serious absence of that in the communities that, you know, we're seeing. And we need to bring that back.
It sounds like you're saying, at least in part, Jennifer B. Lyle, that if you start with job training, that you're starting on, you know, page 37 and you need to start on page one.
Yeah. And, it, you know, there are these tertiary, you know, job training. And I think that, you know, folks who did that really felt like, yeah, that was what was needed. But I think you have to really back up, you know, go back upstream and understand what's preventing people from understanding that, you know, jobs are possible. And then also bringing people back. I think we have some really interesting examples of how we're engaging young people, how we're engaging families in, you know, in their community, and it becomes worthwhile. You know, their community farms, something like what Urban Tilt is doing here. So they have people working in the ground, working in the farms, and they're feeding people in their community. So that's become really important, and all the while they're developing job skills.
Jennifer B. Lyle is Chief of Operation for Building Blocks for Kids Collaborative in Richmond's Iron Triangle. Linda Miller, you're doing some interesting work with food as well in terms of fresh food delivery and juice bars and things like that. Describe what some of those efforts have involved.
Well, we started out about 12 years ago with community gardens just because we started to see, you know, that our kids were getting more and more unhealthy and that, you know, one, they were hardly eating anything. The things that they were eating were the highly processed foods like Top Ramen, hot dogs, sodas, chips, and stuff like that. So we started the gardens, one, so that they could, you know, become accustomed to healthy food, see how food is grown, and really reestablish their connection to the earth and the seasons and so on and so forth. And we've built that program up a lot. And one of our first social enterprises is a alumni run business where our young people deliver fresh organic fruit to residents in the 94124. The business that we're working, which is the Bayview Hunters Point zip code, sorry. And the next business that we're in the process of launching is the Get Fresh Juice Bar and Cafe, which is going to be all, you know, clean foods, fresh squeezed juices, smoothies, you know, like the next level with, you know, chlorophyll and bee pollen and that sort of thing, and really kind of helping people to understand that you are what you eat and to really look at food as, you know, helping your body to heal. And we kind of see that as a microcosm for our whole community. We need our community to heal. We need them to get healthy because we have one of the highest rates of, I think, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, cancer in the country in Bayview Hunters Point. And so we really look at this as an opportunity for us to educate our own community and to make these kinds of food accessible and really raise their consciousness about what it is that people are putting into their body.
Mm-hmm. Lena Miller, founder and co-executive director of Hunters Point Family. We're coming up on a short break. When we return, Sean Jindrai, maybe you can pick up on this point, mm-hmm. because it sounds like it all has to fit together. I mean, that there has to be a certain kind of compassion and support. It's probably not coincidental that the businesses that Lena Miller is developing have to do with sustenance. Mm-hmm. I mean, that these things, is that right? I mean,
well, I think what Lena and Jennifer and Jason have all said, the subtext, which is we have to understand not only the barriers to success, but the psycho-spiritual damage that's been done and how these organizations are providing healing opportunities for these communities.
Let's come back and talk about that more. We invite your participation too. Here's our number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you're dealing with these issues in your neighborhood and your community, if you have thoughts on ways forward, we'd love to hear your ideas on that. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. You can go to our Facebook page as well or our website, kqed.org/forum. Add your comments there. We'll include them when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, economic opportunities for blacks in the Bay Area. There's a conference being sponsored next week called State of the Race, being sponsored by a group called Bay Area Blacks in Philanthropy that's going to tackle some of these topics. Poverty rates high among African Americans, Latinos as well, 27% now in the state of California. Largest declines in income, according to the census in this last period of time, were for young people between the ages of 15 and 24. And we want to talk throughout the rest of this program about opportunities and obstacles and how they can be overcome. Our number, if you'd like to join us, 866-733-6786. Email is forum@kqed.org. You can also go to our Facebook page if you'd like to add your comments there. Sean Ginn, right before the break, you were talking about the ways, I guess, this all has to be knitted together, that it's not enough to just do job training here or education there, that it's a quilt of things.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency for policymakers to think about policy in terms of only access. If you open up access, then that would address the problem. Access to jobs, access to better education. Access is an important piece of the ingredient. But what it doesn't consider is the sort of consequences of block barriers for decades and decades. And what we're seeing in black communities is a sort of a rupture in hopefulness and in the capacity for young people to imagine another way of life. And so what Lena and Jason and Jennifer have, I think, outlined in a number of organizations like Urban Peace Movement, like Youth Uprising, like Leadership Excellence, those organizations on the ground are providing opportunities for young people to reimagine their lives and to heal from everyday kinds of realities. But not just sort of healing from exposure to gun violence, but healing from a sense that, can I have another way of life? And that is an important ingredient to the sort of knit of opportunities that so much get talked about in terms of public policy.
Maybe we focus on this less because it's harder to measure. I mean, how do you measure hopefulness? You know, it's easier to talk about, let's have this job training program. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do we know about how you change that, how you measure hopefulness,
Absolutely. There's an enormous amount of research right now that we know, for example, that there are high rates of depression and anxiety and stress are deeply rooted in black communities, right? Through adults and for young people. We know this. This research has been done. There's an amazing amount of work being done on that. But there's a new genre of research that's actually beginning to measure positive kinds of outcomes, measuring things like, how optimistic are you? Mm-hmm. How hopeful are you? How satisfied are you with your quality of life? These are the kind of measures that I think have really profound public policy leverage. So, for example, we could look at the distinctions between the levels of hopefulness in places like Bayview Hunters Point and look at hopefulness in another neighborhood in San Francisco or anywhere. Then we could look at what are the kinds of opportunities that are beyond jobs in these places that actually facilitate that. And then we can invest in those kinds of opportunities.
Let's hear what our listeners think about this subject this morning. Stan joins us first in San Jose. Stan, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yes, you guys were touching on this earlier, now it's the main subject. I think the answer or the foundation of everything you're talking about is the belief system of the children and the adults raising them. And there's examples of this. The Southern Baptist ministers and the Scientologists got together and gave a code of ethics to kids in East Palo Alto at one point. And, you know, just things like similar to the Ten Commandments. And they were surprised at how many kids didn't know it was wrong to kill, for example. But once they did, they were able to put their ethics in on themselves and change. And it's hard for you as a child to have good expectations when everything that you've seen around you and all the words going into your ear are negative. And these kids really need to see other ways of life, and they really need to have their basic belief system in life pumped up.
Stan, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Lena Miller, you were describing earlier, though, how for many youth, the church in particular is not sort of the first door that they want to walk through, which is not to discount at all the importance of the role of the faith communities. But how I'm interested in your response to what Stan is saying, and if you agree, how you go about imbuing those values in people if the church isn't the door that young people in particular want to walk through.
I think
you know, he's absolutely right. Yes, we do need to have a value system. Yes, we do need to impart that to our young people. Yes, killing is wrong and all of these other things. But the bottom line is somebody's got to be there with these young people day in, day out, who espouse this and who also, when things go wrong in their life and they experience trauma, are there and helping to guide them from a place of hopelessness where they've experienced the world to be a very mean, ugly place, and help, like I said, bring them back and say, okay, I am teaching you that the world is good, it's a good place to be, and that you can have hope, that there is love out there, because I am showing you this. It's not a matter for children, like I said, who've led horrific lives and who have had experiences that you and I may not have made it through, and to say to them, this should be your set of values. Somebody has to be there and to hold their hand and say, yes, this is the set of values, and I'm going to bring you through this. It's not just enough to do the talk. Somebody actually has to be there with them, and I think that's the thing. Okay, so who's going to do that? And if we have a whole bunch of people coming out and saying, here are some values, and we're going to be here with you day in and day out as you go through these things, then that's fine. But the reality is that there are very few people who are out on the front lines, present with these young people.
And Jason Tremieux, I'm curious about how this informs the conference that you're putting on next week, because it doesn't sound like it can be a conference that focuses just on, job opportunities.
That's right. And I think our conference next week, which is on the 12th down in Silicon Valley, our thinking in putting it there and the topics that we want to cover, one, we want to be solution oriented. So we have a number of panelists that are talking about models, not just about job creation, but dealing with the census figures that are now out that are showing, as we have already discussed, the decline in incomes in African-American communities, the out-migration of African-American communities. What are the types of kind of cutting-edge solutions, models that exist that have shown to begin to either reverse those trends or at least deal with many of the things that we've been talking about on the show this far? And so I think our thinking with having it in part in Silicon Valley is to be able to take advantage of some of the technology solutions, some of the innovative thinking that we know is in the Valley. I know this was maybe a controversial decision, but as a board, we felt it was important that as we discuss a regional economy and the role of African Americans in a regional economy, that we look at where, and we host this, where much has been positive in the sense of growth and innovation, and be able to say those are not tools that are only available in Silicon Valley, but we can take these tools back to our own communities. And I think that what Lena and Jennifer are doing in their respective organizations is the example of that.
Jason Tremieux, he is on the board of Bay Area Blacks in Philanthropy. Again, the conference is State of the Race, African Americans Competing in the Regional Economy. It takes place next Wednesday in San Mateo. Let's hear from more of our callers. Jennifer in Oakland is next. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I direct a youth mentoring program at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business called the Center for Young Entrepreneurs at Haas. And we help youth not only develop the business skills that your guests are talking about, but also the life skills, communication, public speaking, writing, the soft skills that employers are looking for. It's a middle school through high school program, and it's free for students. And what really makes it work is that youth are partnered with Haas and Cal students, and they're in a long-term relationship with someone who is in college, someone who got there. And they begin to feel that Haas and Cal are really part of their lives. And 100% of the kids who are in the program graduate from high school and go to college. And so for parents and guardians and educators out there, just wanted you to know about Center for Young Entrepreneurs at Haas.
Jennifer, thanks. Thanks for the observation. I'm sure you also are involved in that San Francisco State is involved in those sorts of mentoring programs. How much of a difference, Shanjana, can that make, that you pair kids who are in college and who are sort of making it to a degree, despite all of the challenges now that young people in college face, with people in young people who are teens and not yet there?
I mean, it makes a tremendous difference, right? Part of the issue is that there aren't enough sort of positive adults in young people's lives. So that's it makes a really important difference. One of the things I always say in terms of mentoring is that there's a tendency for us to focus on mentoring as if only the child needs to be like the adult, meaning that the focus is on the mentoring relationship is on developing the young person. But sometimes as adults, we are not developed. We have issues. We're struggling. We're stressed. And if we're not acutely aware of the ways in which we are dealing and healing and using our own sort of developmental process, then we give it to the young people. So I'm always supportive of mentoring relationships, but relationships in which the adults themselves are engaged with healing and making themselves better human beings.
Let me ask you about another aspect of that and how that relates to the whole question of opportunity and success. One of the census statistics that jumped out at me was that 41% of all female-headed households are poor. I know you've discussed in the past the work that Arnold Perkins and others are doing in Oakland in terms of developing, talking about what it means to be a man and, mm-hmm. and the role of men in African-American community. Talk about the importance of that some, mm-hmm. if you would.
Well, you know, we recognize that part of the issue of our traumatic situation is that there's a disconnect from black men in families and black men in communities. And so what we've done is a sort of an innovative strategy to rebuild the building blocks of black communities is Arnold Perkins called together all the elders, and even one that's 65 and up in Oakland community, black men. And they got together and they talked about what it means to be an elder. And then he called the next generation, which are we call ourselves the Brother Manhood Group, which are black men that are 35 to 55 or so. And then we got together and we talked about what is our role. And they gave us a charge. They said, your charge is to build a system of manhood training for children. Hmm. And your second charge is to call together the 20 and 30-year-olds. So we called another group. And they've met and they're sort of strategizing about what that system might look like. It's a completely innovative strategy about rebuilding black communities. It calls into attention the role of black men. It calls us to action, and it really requires us to use our resources, use our connections to address some of the most pressing issues. And we have a number of black men in Oakland and Richmond that have been a part of this experience.
I want to get back to our calls, but Jennifer B. Lyle, I'm curious about your thoughts on that subject since you work with those kids in Richmond.
Thoughts about men?
Thoughts about the importance of mentorship and yes, the role that men can play and that is being encouraged by the work that Sean Jenright was just describing.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate his comment about, you know, us investigating who we are coming to this work with young people or with communities, because I think we don't want to re-traumatize folks. I also think that the ways in which we need to reintegrate men and bring them back into families and really recreate the role or restate what the role is for African-American men in this community is really important. And it's important that we use innovation but call back to old ways. And I think another issue is really kind of investigating the particular history African-Americans have had in this country, because that has a lot to do with the ways in which African-American men experience the United States and experience their families. And, I mean, we can even see the ways in which our president is treated, and who is an African-American man of that, you know, the highest office. And there are particular ways in which he is treated as a president that no other president in this history has been treated. So I think one is to internally really be supporting our communities, but also be really cognizant of what are the other factors and what's the context for all of the issues, the pain, the unemployment, and the violence in these communities.
And back to our call. Stephen joins us next from Stanford. Stephen, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I just had a quick question about I work with kids in inner city. I'm originally from Richmond. I'm working out at Stanford University now, and I run a nonprofit and teaching health and nutrition. And I'm trying to formulate a program to help kids help themselves by bringing them together, teaching them skills in the culinary, and then also developing a business model for them to actually run their own business, but with people in that business or in the business community to motivate them, help them, show them along the way, accounting, business, all of that kind of stuff to help them function for themselves and by themselves. And I'm having a difficult time trying to network with the right people to do that.
Yeah, Stephen, thanks for the call. Jason Trimue sounds like someone who ought to come to your conference.
Definitely. And I do think, though, that that speaks to a larger point about networks and about philanthropy. And I think that from Red F's experience, what we do in providing financial support to organizations goes far beyond just providing a check. We're very engaged with these organizations. We try to bring as many resources, both financial and human, to the table as well. Because I think, as an earlier point was made, the nonprofit sector, and particularly community-based organizations, are having to look at new models to address what we've all said has been the tragedy and the trauma that our communities have gone through. And so to that end, I think philanthropy has to think about how they're going to support these communities and the types of programs that they've supported in the past. I think we need to learn from what has worked and what hasn't. But we also need philanthropy to take bigger risks. And I think that's true not just for philanthropy, but also for the public sector as well, because the times require it and our communities, the need we have requires it.
To Mary next in Sacramento. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, I hope y'all are doing well today. So I've been listening in, and I totally agree with the pieces around providing mentoring, examining history for people within the Black community. And I think one of the pieces we haven't talked about is how people who are not Black can work on changing their behaviors, their attitudes, and their perceptions of Black people to better increase the success of, for example, of college students once we do get them access into the college system.
Mary, thanks. Thanks for the call. Jennifer B. Lyle, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, actually, I had something to say about the last call.
Yeah,
but
go ahead.
I think that, yes, I agree with Mary. I think there's, we all have a responsibility to think about how we are participating and creating the change we want to see. But in terms of the last call, it was just a response. And what we've found is that, you know, we can always have the idea that we want to change conditions for other folks, but really having them included in the design and development of whatever we're thinking about, the projects or the programs, really helps, because folks come to programs when they see that they are in their best interest and it's really something that they want to see or do. And so, and the same, you know, goes for young people. They'll come if it is something that they really want to do. Mm-hmm. And if it's something that they had an opportunity to co-create, it's even much more successful because it's about their development of skills and it's about, you know, enhancing their, what we see as their significance.
Jennifer Lyle. Shenjin, you want to chime in on that? Sort of a classic question, what the non-Black can do to
help.
Well,
I mean, that's she's opening up an important area of conversation, which is really about, you know, what is the role of race in this? And
yep.
Racism is really the root of what we're dealing with, right? And I think the caller is sort of saying, you know, how is it that I can deal? It's not just sort of your own individual behavior, but what are the role of whites in confronting and changing and transforming white supremacy? Now, that's not the topic of this show, but the consequences of white supremacy is certainly rooted. The consequences are rooted in Black communities. And so one of the things that we're doing in the College of Ethnic Studies is we are educating all of our students about the role of race and about how to dismantle these kinds of issues so that when they come out into the workforce, that they're not reproducing the same kinds of inequality.
Is it harder to have that conversation now than it might have been 10 or 20 years ago? Is there a sense that, oh, come on, we've had that conversation, been there, done that?
I don't know if it's more difficult. I think there's a maturation that racism is much more mature now. And so the conversation is the same, but we're dealing, you know, if racism was 15 years old, you know, 15 years ago, it's, you know, 30 years old now. And so it's a different type of conversation. There's a new, you know, there's sort of now the element of we live in a post-racial society. And so that needs to be deeply interrogated. But the bottom line is that, you know, it's no accident that we're talking about these issues in particularly Black communities. And the barriers that we've seen over the past 20, 30 years in Black communities are largely a result of race.
Mary, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Brandon in San Francisco. Brandon, go ahead.
Hi, you guys. First, I just want to commend you all for what you guys do. I was in the Big Brother, Big Sister program for a year, but in regards to the comment about values, I just think there is no way that we could talk to these kids about values when, as they're, you know, aspiring to maybe get a retail job, they see people who are always of the same color, wearing a suit, heavy set, driving a Mercedes. I mean, think of the values. How can we tell them about values when our society values the top performing scientist, Nobel Prize? He will be able to split $1.5 million, maybe with the team, after a lifetime of accomplishment, whereas the guys at Goldman Sachs routinely every year get that sort of bonus in mid-level. So I don't think there's any way when our society values that kind of thing as being okay. I mean, that's still okay. You know, like Mr. Ferguson, the guy who made the Academy Award-winning film, is amazed that, like, that is still status quo. I don't think, I just think my comment is that there's no way we can talk to people about values when our society thinks that kind of valuation is okay.
Yeah, Brandon.
Off the air.
Brandon, thanks. Lena Miller, you want to talk more about I guess, developing the values that matter most as in a society, in a time, as our caller was suggesting, where the dollar sign seems to trump most everything else?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. You know, when you break it down to the level we're at, well, we're in the ghetto, we're in public housing. I mean, nowhere is it clearer what this country values than there, because as Dr. Jen Wright said, everything, you know, we're the ones who bear the brunt of the collateral damage for the rest of society. I mean, this is every time someone turns on a light switch, you know, for the past 25 years, throws away a piece of garbage or flushes their toilet, Bayview Hunters Point pays the price for that. It's all process here. And everyone kind of says, well, what's wrong with you guys over there? I mean, everything that is wrong, you know, it kind of manifests here. And people are able to see real raw and uncut what's important and what's not, from their interactions with the police to the interactions with the school system. I mean, so then on the one hand, people have these values like thou shalt not kill or whatever, you know, it is. On the other hand, it's very clear those values are for everybody, you know, except us. You know, we have to live to a whole nother set of standards and survive in some kind of way in this country, living in one of the most expensive places to live in the world. And when a family of four in public housing is living on average of $12,000 a year, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And I think really what we have to look at is this is 2011 going on 2012. Life is different. Things have changed. And I think what we have to do is reevaluate what it is that we're really dealing with and find a way to survive and then thrive. And mm-hmm. It's got to be a totally new model, which is why a lot of us are so interested in social enterprise. You know, the things that people have been talking about for the last 20 or 30 years are no longer relevant, and people can still talk about them if they want to, but the reality is where the rubber meets the road, it doesn't work anymore. And so it's up to us, if we want to survive, to start reconceptualizing our reality and what we have to do, you know, like I said, to thrive in that reality.
Lena Miller, founder and co-executive director of Hunters Point Family. There's an email question that also gets at this question of enterprise that I'd be curious to get your response to. This person writes in, can you ask your guests what percentage of businesses are black-owned? For example, in East Palo Alto, for the businesses that people would regularly spend money in, the local gas stations, the small grocery stores, the 7-Eleven, the pizza place, the IKEA, the 31 Flavors, the McDonald's, the Home Depot, how many of those are black-owned or managed? As far as I know, very few. Doesn't that send a terrible message to the community that only Caucasians will own these businesses? Jason Trimio?
Yeah, well, I think I'm trying to find the stat in front of me right now. According to the census data, there's about 1.9 million black-owned businesses in America, of which 1.8 million are sole proprietorships. And so I think we all on this call could talk to the issue of black-owned businesses in our communities. But what I can say is the data that comes out around community-owned businesses, black-owned businesses, is that there is a higher likelihood that those black-owned businesses will employ black residents from those communities. And so, again, I think that if we are really talking about revitalizing our low-income communities, our distressed communities, in part, and I think this is just a part of the solution because of all the other great work that has to happen around this, but we have to be talking about small business development, and we have to be talking about ownership, and we have to be talking about wealth creation. I think if we look at how many black middle class families today, in part, were able to achieve that, There is, you know, the evidence there that it was because they were able to begin a small business, grow that business, hiring folks from their community, and therefore contributing to the overall community's development.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a tendency that across the board, we know that there's been a significant decline in Black communities in terms of small businesses. But I like to look at what is actually happening. Right. If you go to any Black community in Detroit, Chicago, New York, or Oakland, wherever, you could find a Black barbershop. Right. So there are micro enterprises. Right. You go to Black beauty shops. Right. There are brothers that are selling T-shirts and making, you know, incense and oils. These are micro enterprises. Right. A number of examples of how micro enterprises have worked in India and in other places where small loans are made to small groups of people, mm-hmm. and those small groups of people take that money and then make it flourish. They build small businesses from this. I think that we can talk about what's missing, but we also have to look at what is existing, yeah. and then find out what is working and then invest in those kinds of strategies.
Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. And Jennifer B. Lyle, I'd like to give you a last opportunity, if you would please, to add in a last thought, really, in any direction you'd like about what you'd like people to consider as they consider the needs that are before us.
Wow, the burden's on me, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And you only have 30 seconds, sorry.
Okay. Well, I think that everything that was said today is very helpful and important to consider. I think that we really need to understand what we're working against, but I really appreciate what I think Jason said at the end, that there are things happening and people are being creative and innovative. And so I think we talk about this in terms of crisis and it's falling apart, but there are people who are still here and they're still doing good work and they're still doing good thinking, and that there are some significant issues that we do need to address that are particular to African American families living in the United States and in the Bay Area of San Francisco.
Jennifer B. Lyle, thank you. Thanks also to Sean Ginwright, Lena Miller, and Jason Trimu again. The conference is The State of the Race, African Americans Competing in the Regional Economy. It takes place on Wednesday in San Mateo. Our thanks to our interns this week, Adam Susenik, Dominique Tan, Don Clyde, Molly Williams, and Jameson Katsifas. Thanks all for their help as well. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.